I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today we'll be listening to the first half of a talk I gave in April of 2007 on transhumanism and religion at the Arizona State University.
I wanted to start with full disclosure that although I'm not a theologian or even teach sociology of religion anymore, I do have a sociology of religion background and have been an actively engaged person in religious thought for many years. I was raised Unitarian, became a Buddhist about the age of 17. In college, my bachelor's thesis was Altered States of Consciousness and Social Structure, Speaking Tongues in a Pentecostal Church. I spent 4 months in a Pentecostal church. And then I went to Sri Lanka, ordained as a Theravadan monk, and then spent a year in Japan studying Zen. And my wife and my kids and I still go to Buddhist retreats, and I also teach Unitarian Sunday School. But so I don't claim to be a theologian, even though I'm going to be using some theological categories. Through a circuitous set of routes in the late 1980s, early 1990s, which involved starting a journal called Eco-Socialist Review, and then also being involved in the Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago, I ended up becoming a passionate advocate for and defender of the legitimacy of human enhancement technologies, a movement which, as you've heard, is referred to as transhumanism, but we haven't mentioned Julian Huxley yet. He was the one who coined the term back in the 1950s. Julian Huxley being the first director of UNESCO and the brother of Aldous Huxley and a very prominent biologist. And he argued that transhumanism was the idea that the human species could transcend itself, not just simply biologically, but also culturally and psychologically. But the term has certainly come to be associated with human enhancement technologies, the use of genetics, nanotechnology, psychopharmaceuticals, other modalities as we invent them or think of them, to achieve many different kinds of goals, many different life goals. Generally, the concept is that they would be individually chosen life goals, but those kinds of goals being the curing of disability, optimal health, longer life, intelligence, emotional control, as you've heard. And I think for those of us who have kids, at least, ensuring the best lives for our kids, and I think that that's a dimension that's often lost in, at least among our critics, who see this as purely a selfish endeavor. I don't see it that way. I'm also, as a sociologist, I've done a lot of polling, surveying of our membership, attempting to empirically validate notions of what our consensual ideology might be. So to start at the top, that there are certain kind of creedal documents, the Transhumanist Declaration, the Frequently Asked Questions document on our website, which is now 35,000 words. And then a number of other writings by leading lights, people such as Bostrom and Kurzweil. But then filtering down to the bottom, what is it that most people who self-identify as transhumanists actually believe? What kinds of things do they commonly agree with? And I go into greater depth in my paper. But you can summarize those core empirical values that transhumanists generally agree with these five. The general agreement with the right of people to use pro-enhancement technologies, life extension, cognitive enhancement, and so forth. A general humanism and secularism, which I'll return to, of course. Scientific and technological optimism, the notion that science and technology not only can achieve the goals that we're talking about, but that we won't screw everything up if they do achieve these goals. Personhood ethics, which I'll expand upon. And also a strong commitment to individual liberty, reproductive rights, cognitive liberty, the right to control your own brain, and bodily autonomy. And as a consequence of these value commitments, we have come into conflict in many different spheres and many different arguments with people that we've come to refer to as bioconservatives. This is a term that we've begun to use as a term of art as opposed to bio-Luddites, which seems to rub people really the wrong way. Although I'm willing to defend it, but bioconservatives, and so three basic points of conflict on the transhumanist bioconservative dimension. The first, as I mentioned, personhood, the notion that what's of value, what needs to be continued about human existence is not our humanness, but that we are persons, we're self-aware beings, and that that personhood could be instantiated and could be recognized in non-human forms. So, for instance, chimpanzee rights or great ape rights, and on the other hand, some kind of non-organic life form rights. And on the other side, the bioconservatives arguing that there's something called humanness, there's some kind of human dignity or the soul or whatever that needs to be recognized. Another dimension of the conflict has to do with the commitment to enlightenment values, individual liberty, reason, diversity of life goals, progress, and so forth, against notions that there are some kind of generally recognized sacred taboos which shouldn't be contravened, some kind of natural broccoli kind of argument. You know, we can't exactly explain why we shouldn't do it, go in that direction, but it's broccoli, so therefore you can't do it. And then in a set of arguments about risks, which we've also heard articulated here today, transhumanists generally thinking risks are, if not completely knowable, certainly not completely knowable, at least manageable. The, kinds of risks that we face, at least with the technologies that we're talking about, are manageable. And the other side arguing, for instance, from the evolutionary psych point of view, that there's a certain kind of evolved complexity, which is so complex that any effort to intervene in these set of processes will have unintended consequences. And in a religious context, an argument from hubris that this will be some kind of playing God, and playing God always leads to bad outcomes and so forth. Now, the first point I want to make here is that transhumanism is not a hierarchical church. You know, you can talk about these writings and these canonical documents, these creedal statements that we have on our websites, but there are many, many organizations around the world. We now have chapters in Kenya and Nigeria and across Latin America and in St. Petersburg, and we have transhumanists in 100 countries around the world. And their appropriation of these ideas by people across the world is entirely different from the way it's been appropriated or explained by computer scientists in Silicon Valley in the early 90s or by Oxford dons now in the 21st century. So transhumanism is, in fact, an acephalous movement. It's a movement that doesn't have a head. It's a movement that's proliferating. And it's a movement with ancient roots, I would argue, at least going back to the origins of the Enlightenment, where you can find many of these ideas. And as a consequence, when you do the kind of surveying that I've done, and you ask transhumanists, well, given that secularism is... You know, we all understand that that secularism is one of our common assumed things that we agree about. Well, what religious beliefs do you have? Turns out about a quarter of all of the people who call themselves transhumanists, who are members of our organization, are religious or spiritual in some sense. Now, they may identify with terms like spiritual, which doesn't really tell us very much, but we have Buddhists and we have pagans and we have Catholics and we have Unitarians and we have Hindus and Jews and Muslims, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are just a couple of the more prominent, oh, it's cut off there. These are a couple of the more prominent. Peter Houghton, who's a UK transhumanist, who's a Catholic, and Toth Fahel is a nanotechnology engineer, prominent transhumanist. George Dvorsky and Mike Latora, who's sitting here, my close collaborators, both Buddhists, and many other examples. So my thesis is that empirically, since we see that many transhumanists on the ground don't see any contradiction between their expressions of religious faith and their transhumanist views, even if there might be some contradiction between the humanism and materialism expressed by our creedal documents and the creedal documents of some churches, what does it mean empirically that there are people who are trying to put these two together and create some kind of syncretic worldview? And I think if you look at the history of religious and ideological thought, you see that human beings are very creative in this respect, and syncretism is one of the things we do. And I think that there will be in the future many different kinds of trans-spirituality, different in all the major religious faiths and outside of the major faiths, people who have incorporated human enhancement technologies and possibilities and eschatologies and so forth into their worldviews and given them mythopoetic religious meanings. So the four areas I want to briefly address with you in which I think that this is occurring today and will occur in the future is metaphysics, which is what's the relationship of the soul and the body, at least in this context, theodicy, why is there suffering and sin, soteriology, what are the ultimate goals of your faith for you? Is it virtue? Is it transcendence, oneness with God or something? And what is your understanding of the origin of history and the end of history and the events and interruptions in history? I also want to mention that we have for both tactical, strategic reasons, and also in order to pursue these kinds of questions. We've participated in and convened ourselves a number of fora in which these have been discussed. We participated in a Templeton seminar in the UK in June 2004. We organized our own seminar in Toronto in 2004. That led to the creation of the Trans-Spirit List, which Mike runs, which is dedicated to the questions of what neurobiology and evolutionary psych tell us about the neurobiology of religious experience and awe and moral behavior in ways that might be amenable then to some kind of neurotechnological intervention. We published a special issue on religion in the Journal of Evolution and Technology. And subsequently, there have been a number of religious stirrings. There's now the Mormon Transhumanist Association, which I'll discuss briefly. And my think tank, the IEET, has just started the Cyborg Buddha Project, and I'm writing a book called Cyborg Buddha out of that. Okay, metaphysics of body and spirit. Many of the conflicts between religious bioconservatives and transhumanists have to do, or at least in the background, with different interpretations of what it means to have moral standing and whether the mind and reason itself is the sine qua non of human experience, or whether the spirit, some kind of soul or spirit, is something that should be recognized and is what actually would be transferred or would need to be transferred to, for instance, a computer if you were actually going to be doing uploading. And so a lot of these criticisms, like you can read Brent Waters, who's a Christian theologian, who wrote From Human to Post-Human, and most of his argument is that Christians believe in embodiment. Embodiment's important to, and which we mentioned earlier, embodiment's important to resurrection and so on and so forth, and that transhumanists want to have a purely information theoretic approach to the human personhood and upload into computers, and you wouldn't be able to upload the soul, and therefore you wouldn't be able to be a good Christian and do that. Now, Ted Peters, who's a theologian at Lutheran Pacific, has written a great essay called The Soul of Transhumanism and also a wonderful book called Playing God, where he argues that the strict substance dualism that is implicit in such a view is non-creedal, non-scriptural for Christians, which was novel insight for me, not being a Christian theologian myself, but that, in fact, what's creedal and scriptural about an understanding of spirit is not that there's a line of immortal souls that God created at the beginning of time waiting in heaven to be incarnated into bodies, and which will then, after the death of the body, go up and wait in some kind of limbo until the end of time in order to be with God, but rather that God creates Adam out of dirt and breath, and that when the body dies, the soul dies, and that the resurrection at the end of time is actually the resurrection of the body. So that's an entirely different interpretation than the folk Christian beliefs about the spirit. That interpretation means that one of three things. It either means that the soul is a supernatural thing that occurs when you have a human body and brain, or it means that the soul is a non-supernatural thing which is still not reducible to having a brain. Right, so that's kind of the Penrose argument that there's something ineffable about consciousness which can't be reduced to having a brain, but it's not supernatural. Or it means that the soul is actually just what happens in the brain, but it has a certain, what happens in the brain when you are oriented towards God, when you have a certain kind of religious orientation, a relationship to God. So those three perspectives on ensoulment, I argue, and Ted argues, are much more compatible with a transhumanist perspective. Now, it may be that having a completely immaterial body, you would wonder whether those kinds of relationalities or whether those kind of supernatural substances might be generated if you were just simulated the brain in a computer. But you could at least imagine that you could be a Christian and say, well, if it's really about my relationship to God, my feeling a relationship to God with a certain kind of cognition, and that's what the soul is all about, that if I was able to enhance that with neurochemicals, or if I was able to enhance a chimpanzee so that they could think those theological thoughts, or if I was able to upload my brain into a computer, that wouldn't necessarily challenge the metaphysics of the soul. Now, there is within at least the most conservative Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Islam, Christianity, there are non-human beings who do have moral standing and who do have souls of some kind, although the debates about the nature of their souls has been going on for a long time. But angels are one kind of being that are recognized within these traditions as being non-humans who have souls. And so the question arises, at least if you want to raise it, well, if these non-humans can have souls, why couldn't a post-human also have a soul? I mean, apparently souls aren't restricted just to humans. Now, there are some Christians on the far, 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 far right who are very critical and afraid of transhumanism and who argue that, in fact, what transhumanist project is about is an attempt to recreate what is referred to in several places in the Old Testament as Nephilim, or human-angel hybrids, which are apparently supposed to have these enormous bodies and cyborg powers, and they see this as being indicative of in super soldier research from the DOD, and apparently we're agents of Satan in the end times to create Nephilim so that he can carry out his ends. And, you know, I obviously don't buy into that particular scenario, although I like to tweak them whenever I can. But If you do make that kind of an argument, I don't understand it theologically. Why is it that, you know, if a human-angel hybrid would necessarily be evil? So I still think that there's a problem. I still think you could even believe that that the transhumanist project is about creating human-angel hybrids and still think it would be okay. Now, another thing Ted Peters says, which I think is a very interesting insight, is that hubris is an entirely alien import into the Abrahamic traditions. The God of Abraham, precisely the point of monotheism, of a universal, all-knowing, all-powerful God, is that it's not in a zero-sum game with human beings. You know, with the Olympian gods, if you become Hercules, you can, you know, trudge up the mountain and you can knock Zeus down and take away his wife and his property, but we can't do that with the God of Abraham, right? There's no zero-sum relationship between the powers of humanity and the God of Abraham. So there is no hubris, legitimately, within a Christian, Jewish, Muslim tradition. And I think this is an important point. Obviously, lots of, again, folk Christian Abrahamic traditions do believe in hubris, do believe that the Tower of Babel was punishment for hubris and so on and so forth. But Ted argues that that's completely unscriptural. Now, switch over to India and everything to the east. And many commentators have noted that there is far less resistance to ideas of human enhancement and the transhumanist project in general from everywhere from India over to Japan. And the trying to create some kind of meta-cultural theory about what all those cultures have in common, I think, is a little suspicious. But at least one thing that you can say about the Indian subcontinent is that the Hindu-Buddhist ideas of metaphysics, of the soul, are pretty different from the Abrahamic ideas. The soul is not restricted in the first place to humans, so it shares with transhumanism that particular transhumanness of the soul. And also the soul goes through a set of spiritual evolutions from body to body, which eventually lead to demigod states, right? For Buddhists, you actually become more than the gods. A Buddha is actually superior to the gods in all ways. And for the Hindus, you become one with the Godhead, and part of that evolution is to go through and live in heavens and have superhuman abilities for some period of time. And I think you need to contrast this also with the Abrahamic traditions, that there's, because of the what I call human racism in the Abrahamic traditions, the association of moral standing only with being human, there's an enormous anxiety about race mixing in the Abrahamic traditions, because if you start mixing humans and animals or humans and machines, then you create these anomalous, unclean categories that you don't know whether they have spirits or not, and you don't know, and they might be Nephilim, and they might be evil, therefore. And so you see it reflected in Christian anxieties about human-animal hybrid research. And on the other hand, when you go over to this Indian subcontinent, you have multi-armed guys running around in their pantheon. You have this elephant-headed god who's on every altar in every household. And I think that there's some reason to suspect that having a cosmology that includes human-animal chimeras might, in fact, give you a little bit more sympathy to the idea of human-animal chimeras, or a little bit less anxiety about it. Okay, the metaphysics of birth and death. I think these are much more culturally specific ideas than the ideas about the relationship of the soul and the body, but the metaphysics of birth and death often get in the way of transhumanist projects because of beliefs about interfering with the ensoulment of a body at the beginning of life or the transition of the soul at the end of life. And on the other hand, so Catholic theology is one example where this kind of conflict comes in, although I'll talk about that in a second. But on the other hand, pronatalism, the notion that that people have an obligation to be fertile and to have children go forth and multiply, also leads to a line of contact between the Transhumanist Project and many different religious faiths. And an example is the ultra-Orthodox are great believers in and users of fertility medicine. Many rabbis in Israel and the United States have validated even reproductive cloning as a reproductive technique, as long as it takes place within a married context. And so I think you can see that although they may not be on board with, you know, some non-reproductive uses of intervention at the beginning of life, certainly anything that ensured the health or well-being of a child would be something they would endorse. And then you have to say, well, a lot of the objections to these interventions at the beginning of life are not so much about having the metaphysics of it, about the interfering with the soul. It's about that there's a divine plan for how human beings are supposed to be created. For Catholics, it's that, you know, a masturbation is prescribed and therefore you can't have IVF. And, you know, reproduction is supposed to take place within the context of a married, committed relationship between a man and a woman and so on and so forth. And therefore they oppose things like lesbians and single women using reproductive technologies, things which we all support. And so I'm not saying that this, you know, that there's a universal acceptance going to go on between pronatal religious traditions and transhumanism. But there are some points of contact. And interestingly, intriguingly, the Vatican has acknowledge that as long as you changed your genes before you got into had a traditional baby through intercourse, it would be okay for those changes, those genetic changes, to be inheritable. So we call that the germline genetic modification. And so the Catholic Church in a statement 2002 said, as if you were to change your sperm or your eggs and then have the traditional intercourse and have a child, that would be okay. But you can't do it in a petri dish. So even there might be some opportunities. Now, the other end of the life is that there may be end-of-life interventions that interfere with rituals like sitting Shiva or the Tibetan Buddhist ritual of being around a body and reading them the bardo, because the soul is going through transmigration and you read them the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead helps them go through this transition. And those interventions at the end of life, something like if you wanted to slice their head and take, you know, micro samples of it in order to upload those samples into a computer and create a model of their brain, or, you know, whatever, cryonics, those kinds of interventions, things we aren't doing for the most part, might interfere with those rituals. On the other hand, if you have a more materialist understanding of what life is, and you don't actually think that the soul is slowly leaking out of the person's body over time, then you might be able to endorse those things. And I think a larger question at the end of life is, do we have a religious, if you're religious, do you think that life itself is a blessing, right? Is there any particular place in your scripture where you can find that life is a blessing until you're 80, and after that it's not a blessing anymore, and after that you have to kill yourself, right? I don't think in the Old Testament or in the New Testament or in any religious scripture around the world, there is a notion that life is a blessing up to a point and then it's not a blessing anymore. And as a consequence, you have people like Rabbi Neil Gilman saying there's nothing redemptive about death. Death is incoherent. Death is absurd. In Judaism, the indefinite prolongation of life is a moral good, right? He wrote this book, The Death of Death. And you have Charles Harper from the Templeton Foundation saying, I favor radical life extension. I say hooray for life and hooray for more of it. I think that there's quite imaginable, at least in the affirmation of life, that many religious will come around to the transhumanist point of view. Now, another accusation that's made of transhumanists is that we are neo-Gnostic body haters who want to mortify the flesh in order to become purely immaterial spirits, just like those damned heretics of, you know, 300, 400, 500, 600, 700 BC, and that therefore Christians can't be transhumanists because it's a Gnostic heresy. Well, I think there's some truth to the claim. Some of us do talk about the meat puppet in rather disparaging ways and look forward to the day in which we're encased in silicon. On the other hand, we're also accused of being body worshippers because we want to live as long as we possibly can, and we try to have longevity treatments and these kinds of things. And I'm not sure you can necessarily have it both ways. I think, in fact, what's more true is that both are true to a greater or lesser extent for different transhumanists. When you survey transhumanists, not all of them have signed up, for instance, for cryonic suspension. They don't really believe in the importance of physical incarnation enough to do that. And others are looking forward to physical presence in the on the planet. And so some transhumanists want to be bodies and some don't want to be bodies. And Ronald Cole Turner has pointed out that this is very parallel to similar debates in Christian theology between those who think that the resurrection at the end of time will be of the spirit versus those who think it will be of bodies. And, so the transhumanists may be able to touch Christianity that way. And I would also point out that outside of the Judeo-Christian tradition, there are many religious traditions that have seen health and longevity as part of a spiritual project. And the Taoist and yogic traditions around longevity are an example of that. And finally, my own perspective, since I'm often asked, hey, you're a Buddhist, you're into sickness, aging, and death, right? You're supposed to be all for sickness, aging, and death. Buddhists aren't supposed to be all for sickness, aging, and death. They're supposed to serenely accept the inevitability of sickness, aging, and death when it is inevitable, right? And the problem there is that it's not inevitable when you stub your toe and you get it infected. You don't have to then not go to the doctor and get a shot of penicillin because, hey, sickness, aging, and death, it's inevitable. If you're standing in the way of the bus, you don't have to not get out of the way of the bus because sickness, aging, and death, it's inevitable. You do what you need to do in order to live and be healthy and be around to help other people until you can't anymore. And then you serenely accept that you can't anymore. So there's no contradiction here between the notion that if we get technologies which promise indefinite longevity, and they promise indefinite longevity, but then an asteroid's coming at the planet and it's going to whack us all anyway, then you gave it your best shot and now you serenely accept, well, it's all over. let's drink a glass of tea. So I don't think that there's any contradiction here, and I don't think that there is in other traditions as well. Now, the next thing I want to address is theodicy, and here we're going to pick up the pace a little bit. Why is there suffering and evil in the world? The classic question, if there's an all-knowing, all-powerful God, why did he create a world in which there's the Holocaust, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And one answer to that is, well, there is no all-powerful, all-knowing God. There's just a set of karmic rewards and punishments. And what you get in this life is simply what you put into it in a previous life or previously in your life. And does that have any contradiction with a transhumanist project? Well, it doesn't have any contradiction with doing anything in life, really. You could strive mightily to have $1,000 or to have a beautiful wife or to get your kids through college, and you don't have to say, oh, well, I'm not allowed to do this because it's not in my karma. You strive, you see if you do it, and then if you don't accomplish it, you say, well, maybe it had something to do with what's in my karma. And if you do accomplish it, you say, well, maybe it had something to do with what's in my karma. But if you achieve immortality or you achieve cognitive enhancement or you achieve any of the other things we're talking about, it doesn't have anything to do with whether you should have or not should have achieved those or worked for those things if there's a karmic system of reward, right? So it's completely immaterial to transhumanist aspirations.
That was the first half of a talk I gave on transhumanism and religion at the Arizona State University Seminars on Transhumanism and Religion in April of 2007. Stay tuned next week for the second half of that talk. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Our opening and closing music was composed and recorded by Ricardo Campa. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.